Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and anyone in between. This is a presentation on the history of the Green Hornet, and being an old-time radio convention, we're going to center primarily on the history of the radio series of the Green Hornet. We will touch into the serials and television and comic books briefly later on. My right, your left, needs no introduction, but we're going to do it anyway, Mr. Terry Solomonson. Of Audio Classic. My name is Martin Graham. And for the benefit of those listening live right now over yesterdayusa.com, a lot of this is going to be a slideshow presentation, so we're going to try our best to make sure this is as verbal and descriptive as possible. And when questions come from the audience after the presentation, we will try to repeat the questions. To start off with the Green Hornet, there are two people who are primarily responsible for the creation. First of all is George W. Trendle, who what we refer to as the Trendle Empire. Started out as a lawyer, then decided to join partners with a man named King, and purchased a chain of movie theaters for Paramount Studios. And in 1929, right before the stock market crashed and sound was coming in, he did not want to invest the money into putting the sound and all the speakers into the place. They sold it and took that money a year later and invested it in a five-chain radio station called the Michigan Radio Network. He changed the flagship station of WXYZ, the call letters, and the history became made. The other person who's responsible, of course, for the creation of the Green Hornet, when my computer wants to work, is Francis Hamilton Stryker, who we all know created the Lone Ranger. He was the man who was writing scripts in Buffalo before going out to Detroit. And he learned very early on, if you put a carbon copy between sheets of paper, you can and hammer those keys on a typewriter very hard, you can actually get 3 or 4 or even 7 copies of the script done at once. And he also called him real quick in Buffalo, besides him paying $2 a script, so will a radio station in Chicago, one in Arizona, one in Baltimore, and he was making some good money on the same script, which is why a lot of those early programs, they'll have a different cast for the same script in different stations across the country. Of course, it started out with the Lone Ranger. What ended up happening is Trendle, sometime in late 1932, realized that the movies that sold the most tickets when he used to own the theaters was Westerns. So he turned to this man, Jim Jewell, who was the director of the productions. He also formed a repertory company known as the Jim Jewell Players and said, "I want you to create a Western." Well, whatever Western Jewell wrote and directed was so bad, he immediately called up Fran Stryker and said, "I need help. We need a Western. Come up with something real quick." And Fran Stryker, long story short, pulled out the material and put together what we now call the Lone Ranger. Terry can evaluate a little bit more in detail about how the Lone Ranger came to be.
Excuse my voice a little bit. I'm a little under the weather, but I'll try to get through it. Fran was sitting in Buffalo. And a lot of correspondences went back and forth between Detroit and Buffalo in November and December of 1932 and early 33. And what Fran did was basically dusted off a script from a series he wrote called Covered Wagon Days. I believe it was script number 10, which was the genesis of the first Ranger script, which he wrote. Changed around a few things in the script to accommodate what Detroit was looking for, and sent that back, and that's what we started with on that. A lot of credit to Fran has been somewhat minimized over the years, but we do have the WXYZ stationery with the letterhead on it with George Trendle's signature at the bottom, giving a lot of credit to Fran in those early months. Such as these are great ideas, the silver bullets, the silver horseshoes, you know, things like that. Keep these ideas coming, it'll keep popular, the program popular, and as the program grows and audience and stuff, it'll, you know, be a winner, and of course everybody comes out good in the end. But a lot of these things were somewhat minimized over the years for a variety of reasons, probably more legal than anything else. But we do have the correspondences, we do have the letters and copies of the WXYZ letterhead, which clearly gave the authorship to Fran in a lot of cases. not to minimize Mr. Trendle's position. Mr. Trendle, as Grand Striker Jr. Pointed out years ago, and I have to agree with him, he certainly had the radio station, he had the budget, he had the production companies, he had a way of getting this stuff out, he also had a way of signing checks and getting people paid. So, and it was his idea initially, especially if you look at Dick Osgood's book, and I have about 600 hours of audio recordings, which Dick Osgood interviewed many people over 10 years in putting the book together. I have all those interviews that have never been released, the actual audio interviews. And there's a lot to be said about the fact that somebody, whether it was Mr. Trendle himself personally or it was a combination of two or three people kicking around ideas one night, there was no doubt they wanted a Western. And so Fran didn't come up with, let's do a Western. But he did accommodate him in using a Western script that he had previously written. And formulating most of the ideas of what the character would then later be molded into, which was the Lone Ranger. So it's probably a murky area to say, well, who is responsible? Whose one lone idea was it that came up with this Lone Ranger? And I think it's a collaboration more than anything else. But I think an awful lot of credit has to go to Fran. In his ideas, his creativity, the amount of scripts that he was writing constantly. I forget who said it was like writing equivalent to 5 or 6 Bibles a year in the amount of scripts he was banging out on a weekly basis. And by the way, Marty did talk about having carbon paper copies. If I remember right, I think that he made an original and 6 carbons in one pass. So I don't know if you've ever put more than 1 or 2 pieces of carbon paper into a typewriter, and this is, and we're not talking about a word processor here. He had to really bang those keys pretty hard, and of course the copy that he kept, the 7th copy, was barely readable, but was readable. And the other scripts he sold off to stations in Buffalo and Chicago and Oklahoma City and a few others that we know about. And we know some of the names of the actors who played the Ranger in those roles. But let's get back on to where we need to be going here.
Or the Green Hornet. The emphasis should be also the same for the Green Hornet. Both Trendle and Stryker should deserve equal credit. And for the Green Hornet, it seemed a little bit different. The Lone Ranger was actually created more so along what Fran did under the guidance of Trendle and success. Trendle, on the other hand, for the Green Hornet, came up with the idea and went to Stryker and said, can you do this series? It started out with a book, a novel, The Adventures of Jimmy Dale. And according to the novel, Jimmy Dale was a wealthy heir and member of the prestigious St. James Club by day, but by night he enjoyed breaking into businesses and homes to crack their safes for the sheer deviltry of it. He didn't actually steal anything, he just did it because he could. Sort of like a modern-day Robin Hood. And if you notice me reading a few of these things, we have so many details and figures, we don't want to be inaccurate, so you're going to see us looking at a few papers here. It turns out that one woman actually found out his identity and decided to blackmail him and said, your talents be used for good. Why can't you do that? And he said, okay, I'll do that. And he changed his name. He became known to the press as the Gray Seal because he left behind the scenes a paper seal that represented him on the desk, much like the Green Hornet left the seal of the Hornet. And during that time, he realized he could help people. And Fran Stryker said, you know, this kind of pulp hero has been done on an old silent serial. Why can't we do our own version of the radio series? He told Fran Stryker, create something. And Fran Stryker did. Now, to understand the creation of the Green Hornet, besides the Lone Ranger, there's one other show you have to understand. It's called Warner Lester Manhunter. No recordings are known to exist, but this was probably, next to the Lone Ranger, the second most popular program over the WXYZ network. Warner Lester was a profiteer who would actually go out and battle crime to steal the blackmail money and leave the crooks dealing with the police. Similar along the lines of what the Green Hornet would do, except he never really stole all the money, and if he did, he donated it to the Red Cross or USO. And Warner Lester had a secretary, it was his fiance. And interesting, around episode 7, chief of police gets entered into the series, who's so determined, like Inspector Faraday of the Boston Blackie series, he's going to arrest Warner Lester, catch him in the act. He never does, But around episode 22 or 23, when the series started being done as a two-parter for a short while, he actually gets framed, the chief of police gets framed by Crooks, loses his position, and Warner Lester says, I'll help you get your position back. But as a condition, you don't try to come after me anymore. Deal. They solve the problem, he gets reinstated, and moments later, the chief of police hands over his resignation and says, I'm leaving. I'm going to become an associate partner for Warner Lester Manhunter. I see how he's fighting crime. I'm going to be his associate. What's amusing is the chief of police actually wears a derby, smokes a cigar, speaks in an Irish accent, and his name is Michael Axford. And he's the same Michael Axford that appears in The Green Hornet. He was very intelligent on the Warner Lester series, but as the years progressed, he became more dumbed down. But the audience seemed to really, really love him. The man who played him was Jim Irwin, and that's a photo of him. This, we believe, was taken right after he had his first stroke, because he does not look as very well health-wise. And he's actually in the same character. You see the hat and the cigar. Irwin was an ex-vaudevillian, and during the Depression, you have to keep in mind the entire time, this all was done during the Depression. He was desperate for a job, so he took the radio gig, and he loved it. But Trendle didn't. He said, he's too Irish. You need to kill him off, please. And Stryker said, okay, fine, I'll tell you what, I think he's good for the series. I'll bump him off temporarily. He'll relax in the hospital. He'll be recovering. If we get a big fan mail response, he comes back. Trendle said, agreed. They got bombarded for those few weeks while Axford lay in the hospital with flowers, candy, get well cards, and the local hospital got to receive a ton of that. And as Dick Osgood said, the fictional characters back then were real people. And so they realized it. They brought him back. And from that point on, he was the lead character on the Warner Lester Manhunter series. In late 1935, Trendle said, you know, okay, we're tired of this. I think the show's worn its peak. Why don't we kill him off? You have a big villain. He's a Fu Manchu ripoff. He's Dr. Fang. Have a big death-defying fight in a plane, a dive bombing to the ground. I want him to survive at the end, of course, but the villain finally gets killed and closes the series off. Well, they do. But at the end of the episode, the announcer tells, at the end, right before the announcer closes it, Michael Axford tells him, I just got a telegram from a man named Reed, and I'm supposed to go be his bodyguard for his son. So good luck with you two. I hope the marriage is well. The series concluded. And the announcer said, if folks tune in next Friday for The Adventures of the Hornet, he says, starring Mike Axford. And that's definitely the crossover that verified the same Mike Axford character. The interesting also thing about it is that when he was on the Warner Lester series, he was married. But when he was on the Green Hornet series, there is no references to him ever having a wife at all. And, of course, he got dumbed down more in character, as also the early episodes of the Green Hornet. So the character kind of developed throughout the series. Showing you a couple interesting pictures here, George W. Trendle and Sam Stryker early on had some issues about what the Green Hornet was going to look like. So in 1939, they commissioned a pulp artist who had done the pulp artwork you saw earlier up on there of the Lone Ranger pulp magazine, H.J. Ward, commissioned 5 oil paintings. And Ward did a large number of sketches, and Trendle literally tweaked them to a point of almost annoyance. He had to have this done perfect. What you see up here is exactly how Trendle envisioned the Lone Ranger to be. Notice he's wearing gloves. The mask is a surgical mask with 2 ties on both sides. Covers from the nose down. He wears a gray hat, gray gloves, dark suit, dark blue pants. He's blonde-haired, blue-eyed. That's the character of Britt Reed. Cato, you notice, is also wearing the same mask, even though he was usually the guy in the background that's ready to shoot the lights out if he needs it. This is how Trendle envisions the Green Hornet. Regardless of what you see in any of the comic books, the screen interpretations, including the 60s, where the mask is from the nose, covering the eyes, which was similar to a Lone Ranger interpretation. This is exactly how Trendle envisioned it. So when you listen to the episodes, you now know what he looks like. This is an official signia in 1939. They also commissioned other artists besides H.J. Ward to come up with an insignia that could be stamped on all products. That includes rings, comic books. In fact, the cover of the comic books even features the same insignia. It was supposed to be an official seal, and it was Trendle's way of copywriting and trademarking his own property, because he was very protective over it. The studio, of course, before they had the conceptions, did their own renditions. In this case, the studio cast is posing or a silly, interesting picture, but you see a shadow of the Hornet in the background, and there's an interpretation of a gas gun. And in the paintings that H.J. Ward did, there's no gas gun. This is, until the cliffhanger serial in 1936 for Universal, the only interpretation of what the gas gun would look like. And obviously they probably just slapped this thing together. I don't think they put a lot of expense and time into it. But you can see that they put a little effort into that picture there. The series was very interesting. We're going to get to the early episodes very shortly. But when they created the series, The Green Hornet, they could not get a sponsor. What you're looking at is an early picture of Detroit Creamery. This was in November of 36, about 11 months after the series premiered. They decided to get their, managed to secure their first sponsor. And within 3 months, Detroit Creamery sales went 10 times more. They had to hire people left and right. They could not keep up with the demand. And to give you an idea of how popular the radio show was for Detroit Creamery, Detroit Creamery was one of 5 creameries in the state of Michigan, and it was the only one that was not advertised in newspapers and the only one that was not advertised in the phone book. So the radio was the only means, and they grew that fast, considering their competition. Trendle milked that for every what it's worth. Even in the 40s, when trying to get new sponsors, he would use the Detroit Creamery sponsor as a sample example of how popular the series was. And interestingly, every time he created a press book for each potential sponsor, the number of fan letters that came in and the number of sales ranks for the sponsor slightly kept growing a little bit each time. He was kind of stretching the truth a little bit. So we had to go through a lot of internal correspondence and office memorandum to get some more accurate details at the time the success was coming along. The Green Hornet's earliest episodes was created more along the lines of the Warner Lester series. The Green Hornet was trying to profiteer from his ventures, and if you all are familiar with the Lone Ranger, you'll notice that the villains are never minorities. The only minority is Tonto, who is the sidekick. The villains were never depicted as African Americans, Orientals, or Indians. So when they did the Green Hornet, Fran Stryker carried over the same formula. Minority was obviously a Japanese Kato. But the villains were never minorities. The freedom of the press and freedom of the speech was something that the Lone Ranger was very strong for. Britt Reed also did the exact same thing on both aspects, including, obviously, the newspaper. And you catch on the similarities from one show to the other, not just the early episodes, but the later episodes, because it was a formula that most people call a cookie-cutter formula. It worked. And the show was extremely popular. One thing we noticed with a couple people, when we asked them what you envisioned the Black Beauty to look like on the Green Hornet, the Black Beauty car was never mentioned by make or model. It was only black and colored, and it was never mentioned what kind. And most people say, well, when I listen to radio shows, I envision this, the 1960s Black Beauty from the TV series. And surprisingly, no. What it really was, as you see in this advertisement in the first season of 1936, it was a plain, regular car. There was nothing special except for what was under the hood. The earliest broadcast, the police tried to pull over the Black Beauty because they tried to catch the Hornet in the earliest of them. They were pulling over so many innocent people, they had to stop. And Fran Stryker used a lot of principles and practical ideas for the series and said, let's make some rational ideas of how realistic the police would try something and then just drop it so we don't have to encounter that issue in the future. One thing Fran Stryker was very picky was the correspondence. If WXYZ or Trendle received any correspondence or letters catching attention to some sort of aspect of the series, like, well, why doesn't the Green Hornet do this? Fran Stryker would try to incorporate it in the very next script to explain the reasoning and then drop it. It was a one-time mention. Let's make sure we don't have people questioning oddities that really do need to be questioned. For the Black Beauty, for example, in episode 38, Britt Reed actually bolted heavy flaps to the rear fenders to prevent police bullets from blowing out the tires. Somebody apparently, according to an inter-office memo, wrote in the letter, says, why isn't the car being shot at by the tires? There's an excellent example. In episode 26, the license plate was reported to be covered with dirt. But interestingly, a couple years later, Axford got a good look at the license plate and claimed there was no license plate at all. So apparently Britt Reed continued to change it. Stryker was very good at continuity, and as such, he wanted to make sure there wasn't going to be a flaw when someone else wrote a script for the same series. 3 years later, after that one episode I just mentioned about the missing license plate, Axford gets another look at the license plate. It's a fake plate. He said, I've been spotting that all over the city for years. So obviously they kept changing the routine so it wouldn't be the same routine. In one early episode, Axford gets really clever and shoots bullet holes into the Black Beauty. And it turns out Cato's the man who actually fixes the bullet holes, patches it up, spruces the motor up. But like the Green Hornet, where all cowboy would actually put his hand on the side of his trusty steed before going off on a race to tell him we're going to go on a long trip, Silver. In the earliest episodes, Britt Reed would rub his hand on the hood of the car and talk to the car for a moment. We're going to go on a long ride here. We're going to go on a good ride. We're going to push it farther and faster than we could ever do. And as a result, a couple times Cato would say, excuse me, because I wasn't talking to you, Cato. That dropped after a short period of time. Other interesting things about the radio series of the Green Hornet, the early episodes reveal things you don't realize in the later ones because Stryker assumed people just knew what was going on. Trivia question, who's driving the Black Beauty on the radio series? Anyone want to take a guess? Raise a hand. Cato, correct. Most of the time, incorrect. Cato does not drive the Black Beauty. If you listen to the announcer in the middle of each episode when they're getting into the Black Beauty, Britt Reed slides behind the wheel, gets himself comfortable, pushes the button starter to get the rev of the engine. The serials and the comics that was all and the TV series, Cato always drives the car. But Britt Reed on the radio series is the one who drives the car. And the only exceptions are when he tells Cato, remain behind the wheel just in case the police rush over in here to keep, or you need to speed away to get them away from the scene that they're guarding so I can sneak into the house. It's very rare, and I say it's one in every 100 episodes, that Cato actually drives the Black Beauty. Britt Reed is the one who does it. This here you see is Al Hodge. He was the very first person to play the role of the Green Hornet. He was Trendle's favorite, and like a lot of the actors, the characters were molded after the actors who were assigned the roles. Al Hodge was one of the four actors to play the role of Green Hornet, and according to Dick Osgood, his father actually worked for Buffalo Bill. When the first broadcast was over, Hodge was so nervous and feared that Trendle would fire him because he might have given a bad performance. He actually went back to his rented room in Webster Hall behind the Maccabees building where it was broadcast. He broke out in an all-over rash of hives. Turns out he was Trendle's best, and nobody could ever do better than Hodge. Hodge was signed originally for $25 a week to do the series, the same as Raymond Toyo and Lee Allman. So even though he was a star, he was getting paid the same. And incidentally, $25 a week also meant you would play supporting roles in any other shows, as many as you gave, unlimited, and it clearly said it in the talent contract. So he could work you 6 days a week if he wanted to. In October 1937, his salary went up $10, and then $5 every year after that. But in the summer of 1940, and we haven't exactly found out the exact date, Al Hodge had an encounter with H. Allen Campbell, who was the general manager for the Michigan Radio Network. He returned from a four-day vacation and explained that he heard the Green Hornet broadcast over a Canadian radio station. And the dialogue somewhere went like this, and Campbell was a southerner. Yeah, I heard there was something about it being broadcast up there in Canada. And Hodge says, yeah, funny thing, it was sponsored. Yeah, I heard something about that, too. Well, have you checked my contract? No, I don't say it, not recently. And Hodge says, well, in a contract, if it's sponsored, I get paid more money. We're going to have to double-check that when that contract gets renewed in a couple of months, aren't we? Hodge immediately decided to go compose a letter to Paul Dozell, who was executive secretary of the Actors Equity Association, asking for information about a new broadcast union who was really going after Trendle for short-shifting and short-cashing the cast. And as a result, once he signed up for AFRA, Al Hodge got $100 a broadcast, plus more if it was sponsored. Trendle did not like that, and the cast had a party, because they realized this is a stepping stone, and one by one they started signing. And after the early years, they were making some decent money. Now, to give you an idea, $25 a week is not bad during the Depression, because if you do your math, that's $1,200 a year. And last I heard, someone said in 1934 or 35, you could buy a house for about $2,000. So that's really not bad for the Depression era. But if you were working in New York City, you were paid a lot more money for doing radio programs. Jim Irwin, who we mentioned was an ex-vaudevillian, he lived with Britt Reed in his apartment, for anyone who'd never caught that. He had his own bedroom, He was the bodyguard, and in the earliest episodes, they waited till he went out at night to either go try to catch the Hornet, who he was obsessed with, or go after or help the police on some beat or investigate something. Then they would sneak out through the back of the clothes press, the secret compartment, go through the hallways, etc. Jim Irwin, in October of 1936, they make a reference in an episode about his Model T black sedan, license plate number 4229. And it's New York State. And once we saw that, we realized the series takes place in New York. There is a number of episodes where they make references to moving up north to Canada. There's the Great Lakes within driving distance. And from a number of episodes, for quite a long time, we have always assumed it was taking place in Detroit. And it turns out it's New York State. And for about a month, in October of 1936, they were making numerous references to New Yorkers being Slim Slam. They returned to New York, and they were discovering they were being scammed by the cruise line or something. It seems like for 1 month, Fran Stryker wanted to emphasize where the story takes place. But having read all 1,000-plus radio scripts, that never occurs anywhere else in the rest of the series where the location of the series takes place. Jim Irwin, in December of 1936, got very ill. He actually had a stroke, and they had to do something at the last minute. And Fran Stryker came up with a clever idea. He said, remember the Warner Lester series where we shot and wounded poor expert and he lies in the hospital? Let's do that again. And they did. And once again, the letters and cards and everything poured in. He was written out of the series, and that's when they introduced Ed Lowery and a number of other supporting actors, the characters that you often hear on the program nowadays. And that's how they started it. About 6 months later, Irwin felt much better, and he came back to the series, and there you see Jim Irwin playing the role of expert, and there is Lee Allman, who was, of course, Linnell of Lenore. Irwin's final appearance was January 6, 1938. He had another stroke that prevented him from reprising the role he was best capable of playing. Tom Hawkes and Jasper Jenks were then introduced to the series. And 6 months later, they realized Axford's not coming back to the series. In fact, he died on June 24. And newspapers in Michigan, if you can take the reports by the reporters accurate, reported that fans of the radio program were jamming the cathedral for his funeral, and the crowd overflowed into the streets. He was that well loved. 8 months later, in the broadcast of August 16, 1938, another Irishman comes into the picture, and his name's not Michael Axford, his name is Timothy Axford. And it turns out he's the brother of Mike Axford. And that's how Fran Stryker was able to bring the character back in. By this point, it was another actor named Haggerty who was able to play the role. And oddly enough, they never made reference to Mike Axford dying on the series. They said he went back west and joined Britt Reed's father. And funny thing, they eventually dropped that, never even made reference to what happened to Timothy Axford, and a couple months later, Mike Axford made a return to the program. There's a couple episodes in 1938 that exist, and some odd reason, they actually refer to him as Axford. And since they never referred to him by first name, we've always assumed that was Mike Axford. Turns out it's Timothy. So some recordings of his brother are circulating among collectors, but we've never known that because they never made reference to the first name or any reference to brother. What you see up there is Lee Allman. She played Miss Kate. She was never given any name. She was just simply a secretary for the first two broadcasts. She was assigned the name of Miss Kate beginning by episode 9. Her few brief lines started expanding, and she became almost a regular character on every episode. For some odd reason, episode 10, she is referred to as Miss Scott. And then with episode 11, they went back to Miss Kate. We don't know why. It was definitely Lee Allman, according to the script. And as far as we understand, Fran Stryker might have just decided to change the name, and it's early on. They're creating the series as they went about, and didn't like Miss Scott and went back to Miss Kate. Terry knows a little bit more about Lee Allman.
Lee was somewhat of a utilitarian actress at WXYZ. She appeared not only on The Hornet, but on Ranger and on Preston. There were a number of other programs that WXYZ did, like Ann Worth Housewife and a number of other series and smaller shows. But mostly the big three, as it's called, Ranger, Hornet, and Preston are the ones that most people remember, and they don't remember a lot of the other shows. But early on, when Earl Groger was alive, who was playing a Lone Ranger, Lee and Earl casually dated for a period of time. They also attended the same school, Wayne State University, which had a campus just a block or two away from the Backleys building where a lot of the broadcasts were done. She was a wonderful, wonderful lady. And up until her death in, I believe it was 89, she used to frequent this convention quite a lot. Every year she'd come over. She lived in New Jersey at the time. And we're trying to pin down, we're pretty sure she only had three vacations in the entire run of the Green Hornet. One of the things that Marty pointed out, and I'm going to diverge here a little bit, we have the talent contracts on a lot of these people. And I talked to Fred Foy once about this, and he had absolutely no idea that this verbiage was in there, or he's since long forgotten. There was a phrase in his contract that he could be worked a, quote, unreasonable number of shows per week, unquote. And if you look through a lot of the talent contracts, they can be worked as many episodes as the station deems fit. So it's whether it's three episodes or 38 episodes, they're going to be worked. And so... it's not surprising that Lee only took three vacations. We know the dates on two of them pretty well because a substitute was brought in, like Marty had pointed out. And one of them, I'm in contact with the Lee's two children to find out when they were born because we're pretty sure one of them was on maternity leave. So we're hoping that that's the case. We'll bear a little more detailed proof. But she was a wonderful individual, and she came over here quite a lot to the convention with her husband, better known as Slim. But she had an unbelievable career at WXYZ. And Fran wrote a lot of female roles in scripts and tried to develop things. And whether he was blocked with this approach to a more dominant female character or not, I don't know. I don't know if he tried it, and if it worked, he continued on, or if management said we're getting a little too far away from the formula here or not. But Lee certainly carried more than her share of heavy and strong roles throughout her career at WXYZ.
What you see up there, who you see up there is actually Raymond Hayashi. He played the role of Kato. He really was Japanese, and like we mentioned, Franz Stryker modeled the characters after the actors who played them. His last name was it was changed to Toyo. That was by Jim Jewell, who said, you need a better last name. And he played the role probably the best on the series because you can tell the difference between a Japanese actor who's trying to speak English as opposed to an English actor who's trying to fake Japanese. And he was a very quiet, very short, very polite actor who showed up at the set. Everybody had a very good working relationship. Few of them had drinking problems, the personal issues here and there, but when they came into the building, it was purely professional. And there was we have found no evidence that anyone took anything against them being Japanese, regardless of what was going on overseas, because that growing issue, as this got closer to a U.S. entry into the war, was starting to make some people nervous. In this publicity photo done at the studio, he's sitting behind a black car with his gloves, without the mask, though, and apparently this is what they used to symbolize Kato behind the Black Beauty. There's a sad story to Kato's, Raymond Toyo's closing chapter to the Green Hornet saga. Sometime in 1942, and the exact date remains unknown, Raymond Toyo came upon a problem that offered no solution. Because of the war, the U.S. government sent official notice Toyo had to be sent back to Japan. Dick Osgood, he wrote a wonderful book called Wixie Wonderland, and the more we've dug into this, we discovered his book is really accurate and detailed. It's really a good book. Osgood was broadcasting a series called March of Victory for the high-speed gas stations, and a number of the scripts had to be cleared through six departments in Washington. Well, Toyo believed that maybe Osgood had an inside with the government, and so maybe he could do it. And Osgood said, I really don't, to be honest. I just have people who approve what's in the script. They don't have that kind of department. They don't have that kind of clout. Trendle himself had no influence with members of Congress. Only in Detroit did he have influence. But so he said, you're going to have the nervous saved on it. It serves for you. It can't be waived. According to Osgood, the Japanese actor disappeared in 1942, presumably to a concentration camp in the West, and no one at WXYZ ever saw Toyo again.
There's one other interesting little footnote that Dick Osgood told me once a long time ago. The actors used to go to an establishment called the Alcove. And they served sandwiches there and stuff, but they really went down to get a couple of beers or drinks or whatever between their East and West Coast and Midwest broadcast times. It was a period where they had an hour between shows, so they would go down. Sometimes the libations would be a little more than normal, and that led to some problems. But in one night, and this was sometime clearly after December 7th of 41, and it was probably in around March or April of 42, just before Toyo left, they decided to go over to Windsor one night for a dinner at a restaurant, which is Canada International. Well, they all got in the cars and they drove across the Ambassador Bridge, and they didn't have any problem getting over there. The problem was not getting him back into the country, since he was Japanese and we were at war, and they didn't have any paperwork. And I guess this held up for quite a while at the border, and they got a broadcast coming up, another feed to do, and they don't know what they're going to do for their actors. So eventually, enough phone calls were made and a few of the official decisions were made to let them come back into the country again. But that was very, very close between that period of time and when all of a sudden he just disappeared. Nobody knows where he went or what happened to him after that. But Dick said it was it gave an awful lot of very nervous, almost heart-stopping moments there to get him back to the studio so they could do the broadcast, you know, as the clock was ticking away. But they never did that again.
The sketch you see up here on the wall was provided by a very good friend of mine named Saunders. This is what a professional oil painter who did pulp cover art, we mentioned H.J. Ward, would actually do before he made the oil painting. And he did a number of them for George Trendle, who wanted them to, for two reasons. One, to use as advertising, but two, to frame up around the plate, the building. Because by this, by 1939, he realized two things. One, if we're going to promote, we need illustrations and we need to keep it consistent as what the Hornet and Kato looks like. The other was that in 1939, Universal Studios licensed the rights to do two cliffhanger serials. And as a result, he needed to send them background information to make sure they don't mess anything up. So Ward did a ton of conceptions. This one never became an. This is, as you notice, he's handling wire cutters, and he's wearing his gloves. The Black Beauty's in the background. Obviously, it's in the garage. The wire cutters were very prominent in the earliest episodes of the series, where Kato would either cut the wires to keep people from trying to phone the police when they receive a visit from the Hornet, or for other malicious mischief that they caused, breaking, I don't know what rules, because they're debating what laws there was at the time. But this is a sketch that you probably will never see any other time. It never became an oil painting. But we're going to show you another conception sketch that's more interesting. This is the one that Trendle finally approved after five different renditions. We don't know why it has the number 8 up there. Where's the... All right, my pointer's not working.
Top of the photo.
It drives Cap crazy. You got to get one of these.
Top of the photo.
Yeah, top of the photo, you see a number 8. And we're not 100% certain why this. We don't think it's the 8th rendition of this. We actually think it's the 8th of many sketches he came up with, but only 5 paintings were done. The final one is what you see there, where the insignia. And to give you an idea of the concepts, when they wanted to come up with what the Hornet mask should look like, they said, we need to know where the insignia is going to go on the mask before they do the movie. And everyone tossed around ideas. Should we have two, one on each cheek side? Should we have one big one planted in the front? Should we have one in the center? They rarely consulted Francis Dreiger. They said, did you make any reference on the radio show where what would be on the mask? He said, no. They said, okay, thanks. We'll come up with something. So they did, and they decided to plant a white one in the center of a green mask in the dead center at the bottom near his mouth would be. And that is the finished oil painting. And if you look at the cover of our book, which everyone's seen the postcards of, we actually had them tweak it a little bit with hair color and eyes. This is the painting that they used to make, to replicate it, so that the hornet that George W. Trendle envisioned for the series and Franz Stryker agreed was actually done and will be carried over. This is another oil painting, again a shadow. We don't know if this was actually suggested by some of the portraits or photos they had done in the studio for our local promoting, but you can also see where that same oil painting was used to promote the series. This was in Radio Daily, I think it was about 1939, and this one promotes the radio program for the local sponsor, for the station. This magazine in particular didn't really go out to the general public. It went out to people who were station managers who wanted to know what transcription discs can we get to bring to our series. And so Trendle did quite a number of them. Before they did the actual mask, a man named Krigler did a whole bunch of silly sketches. And they tossed them about, and they did a few of them here and there. And then they were tossed to H.J. Ward, and then they polished it. These are original conception sketches we found in Trendle's archive. And the interoffice correspondence helped us, and with Saunders' help, we were able to pinpoint exactly what these were and how they were came about. This is for your general laughter of what you might have seen the Hornet in later years in the comic book. That one looks like a wrestler from the 50s. That one probably wouldn't have gone very well in World War II. This one is the giant bug face. This one we found interesting. And this is the one where it's a hornet plastered face in the center, and basically the antlers and they're in the seat and the antenna would come out of the sides of the face. They even did up a design of how it should go on his face. But more importantly, anyone notice the mask in this portrait photo that was done by the studio? That's pretty much close to the mask of the bug that plastered right on the mask. Now keep in mind they weren't going to do any exact what they did sketch because they were working with what materials physically they had, but we pretty much figure out, we assume this is what they used. And there's an example of what the hornet looked like, and since this was predating even the oil painting right before it, this is probably the earliest first time you've ever seen an actual mask of the green hornet. This is popularly circulated, but I'm surprised a number of people never caught that mask. No one's really noticed it. What you also see here is advertisements, and this one's from February of 1938, early February 38. They had just started recording the transcription discs for the Lone Ranger, and because it was three times a week, they knew within 6 weeks they had plenty of discs in stock that they can then start sending out to the station. The Green Hornet being once or twice a week, they started recording them generally in around August or so of 1939. But at that point, it took them a very long time to stockpile enough before they could start offering discs. Amusingly, a couple of these that we have seen also tell the station managers some restrictions and stipulations that you don't usually see in such advertisements. And one of them is that you have to broadcast the show twice a week. Usually that's the discretion of the station manager because of the sponsor, and they work with the sponsor. Do you want it once a week? You want it twice a week, what day of the week? Trendle actually had certain specifics of how you're going to do it. And the discs, by the way, when they were sent out, were priced according to the wattage and the large area number of listeners for the station. So the bigger the station's listening area, the more money it costs for the discs. At one point, Trendle offered to get them the sponsors, but then he got a percentage of the fee from the sponsor fees, which also added. And to give you an idea, this is when we discovered how much it costs for transcription discs. When he started having the Green Hornets done in 1939, they were hooked up to Chicago, and then they were recorded in Chicago, and the cost was about $90 a disc. That's $90 back then. That's a lot of money. The actors who were getting pretty decent pay at $25 a week, that's almost a month's pay to get a disc. So Trendle really had to make a fortune. But after the first couple years of his Michigan radio network, he was losing money, and if it wasn't for the Lone Ranger being popularly syndicated eventually, he probably would have lost his shirt. His parents never approved of him having a radio station, and I don't think they had any regrets later on. We also discovered something very interesting when we were doing these transcription discs, was going through the details, and then they recorded them. There's one recording of the Lone Ranger that exists in December 17, 1937.
Yeah,
right? We always wondered why there's a December 17, 1937, but then they don't record the Rangers until January of 38. Well, we found a late December 37 Hornet script in which the Green Hornet sneaks into the back window of a judge's house, and the judge is listening to the Lone Ranger on the radio. And in the script it says, play transcription disc. Now, the scripts that Sram Stryker wrote were usually 2 to 3 weeks in advance, because they were always scribbling it. The date had to change. You see a whole bunch of them change real quick. They scribble the dates on the script to correct it. So we suspect they pre-recorded that recording as a result of a Green Hornet broadcast, and that's what kicked in the idea of doing transcription. And there are a few recordings from May of 38 of the Green Hornet. We've often been puzzled about why there's a handful of those. We're wondering if there's not a story behind that as well. In this advertisement sent out to the local newspapers, you notice it says WXXX and 00 and time. That's to be filled in by the stations. These matted advertisements, there's tons of them, but we couldn't actually scan it. We had some issues scanning the other week. But if you see it says wanted by the police of the underworld and the Green Hornet, that same advertisement, if you look at it carefully, was also used for the Lone Ranger. So George Trundle used everything as best as he could. This is the one that we actually enjoy the most. Terry got a kick out of this. See the silhouette of the Hornet? And that's a really good artist conception. It's almost EC Comics and their Jack Kirby-style art for the early comics. Another official insignia. Pictures go a little fast now, folks. And then we get to the comic books, around 1940. And we're going to go over these really, really briefly. As I said, in the comics, Kato drives the car. But also the goggles he's wearing, since this is 1940, was not inspired by the artist himself, Burt Whitman. He got that idea from Universal People. He started the idea of Kato wearing the goggles. The comic books, this actually comes from a newspaper daily, incidentally, that never succeeded, but the panels exist. In 1940, there was 6 issues by Helmut of the Green Hornet. And you notice the logo on the middle left on there, as I mentioned. They tried to put that Hornet seal on any product that bore the name of the Green Hornet. The first six comic books were very thick. They were about 64 pages. They had about 8 good stories. And the first 3 were all adaptations of Sram Stryker's radio script. Apparently, they were running out of story material, came up with originals that were really close to the radio series. But beginning with issue 7, they began doing original stories, and all of a sudden the Green Hornet's no longer combating criminals. He's combating a killer clown, dinosaurs that were thawed out, and a bunch of other stuff that Trendle and Stryker said, we don't like that, we can't do it. But they had no say over it because the contract with Harvey, it went from Helmut to Harvey, because they could do whatever they wanted after the initial 6 script. So when it transferred to Harvey and they picked it up, the clause didn't stipulate beginning with issue 7. Obviously, in the comics, as you see here, they also have a panel promoting the radio series because you want to do as much crossover as you can. And this one, it says, on the air and in the movie, because the cliffhanger serial was still being syndicated. Trendle took advantage of every popularity he could. In 1940, it was election year. So we had bumper stickers, Green Hornet for governor. But he was not very proud of this one. Down in Florida, someone had a brand mix called the Green Hornet. It's a drink mix, and he sends a cease and desist letter in 1944 and said, you got to redo the label and pay us royalty. And they said, no, it's nothing to do with the radio series. Anything that had Green Hornet, he went after. He sent a cease and desist. And in the early years, the trademarks and copyrights were a little bit more vague, and certain rules weren't yet established. He succeeded. And the intimidation also earned him quite a lot of money. During the 70s, when he found out racehorses were being called Green Hornet, he sent cease and desist letters. By the 70s, they were telling him to go away. That's the new label that they fixed up. That's the Green Parrot. 1945. World War II came into play, and the Kato became a big issue. As it got closer to the war, they started making numerous references. At first, it was Kato being very concerned and upset over what's going on overseas. He was deeply concerned. that apparently didn't seem to calm some problems they were getting from letters and concerned listeners. They talked about my ideas, and in June of 1940, officially, he became, went from Japanese to Filipino. Now, Kato was a Japanese beginning with episode 3, Oriental during the first two broadcasts, but he became Filipino in June of 1940. We have the dates. It's all the details are going to be in the books that we're putting out. We forgot to write the dates here. There's always been a myth that he became Filipino after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We tracked all that down. Because most people don't do research. They look at encyclopedias and they copy the material and they say, okay, that's the fact. They assume that's the fact. They don't dig in the archives. We tracked down the earliest source that said it. We looked it up even beyond that, found out the newspaper. In 1966, because of the TV series, Raymond Muir, who was the general counsel for Trendle, actually was interviewed about it, and he had recollections about what was about the Green Hornet and so on. He was wrong on a lot of that, and we believe that's where the myth started originating. He was Filipino before World War II. And the humorous part is when they decided to call him Filipino, before that, right before that, Stryker would call him Oriental, Faithful Valet. It wasn't always mentioned Japanese every week. When they did Filipino, it was mentioned like 6 or 7 times in the same script. As a Filipino valet, Filipino valet, it was repeated. Oh, my hometown of the home country of Philippines. I'm sorry, he's Filipino. We have no issues. It was repeated zillions of times. They stopped it after a while. About August, they kind of went back to the Oriental. But right after Pearl Harbor, remember they were a few scripts ahead in advance. In January, the broadcast of January 17, 1942, they immediately began referring to it, Filipino, Filipino, Filipino. So it wasn't right after Pearl Harbor, but pretty close after, they began emphasizing that again. And they stuck to that for about 6 months. There's one other rumor that myth seems to circulate around, and we're actually digging farther into. We think there's actually more to this. J. Edgar Hoover in 1939 sent a letter to Trendle and praised the Green Hornet. This is the kind of program people should be enjoying. But rumor has it that he was also against the clause, he hunts the biggest of all game, public enemies that even the G-men cannot reach. We thought, that's a little awkward. How could in 1939 or 40, that far into the series, he decide now to oppose the idea of using the G-men clause? That seems awkward. Because of the ongoing war overseas, they decided instead of making racketeers, they wanted to have them fight saboteurs as well. And it was, we suspect it was, they decided to change the opening clause, the opening phrase in the beginning of the episode, when they decided to start adding saboteurs into the mix. Because J. Edgar Hoover had sent a praise of letter. Why would he actually send another letter saying, take that away from the program? This doesn't seem right, and we're still digging into it, but we suspect that's also another myth that has circulated over the years and been reprinted a zillion times. The one big thing everybody knows about the Green Hornet, and they talk about, and it seems to be the hottest trivia of the year, is that his connection with the Lone Ranger. What happened is in 1946 and 47, Leagues of Decency were having issues over the Green Hornet. Little kids were soaking windows in the local streets and signing it the Green Hornet. They thought it was a bad influence. And they were receiving too many letters, and Trendle sat down with Stryker and said, we need to make him aid and be working with the police. Stryker said, we can't do it overnight. Trendle said, can you change that? We want him to be a master vigilante, but now working for the police department. So he incorporated Linda Travis, who was the secretary of Dan Reed. And you all familiar with the one where she gets in the back of the Black Beauty, overhears the conversation, discovers, guess who the Hornet is, and that story. The recordings of that revelation and the episodes after that have been in circulation. A lot of people say I've never heard that. Radio Spirit, about 4 or 5 years ago, came out with a box set, and it actually had the recordings where he realized with Linda Travis, we're going to need to sit down and have a discussion about with my father when he comes into town. I got to reveal to him that I'm the Hornet. And what happens is, if you listen to the recording in the background, at first his father's upset, he's angered, and then he stops for a moment and starts chuckling. And he tells him, you know, you see that masked man on that painting up on the wall of this guy who rode the Western Plains? That's a family relative of yours. I rode with him. And you realize that Dan Reed, that was the father of the Green Hornet, was actually the same Dan Reed that rode with the Lone Ranger on the radio series, introduced to the program in a story arc in Christmas of 1942. Those recordings do exist. And very quietly in the background, incidentally, I think you hear the Wound Cell Overture playing. They wanted to do this just right. This is John Todd. He was the actor who played the Tonto on The Lone Ranger. He played the role of Dan Reed almost the entire time on the series, and that was the only time he seemed to have crossed over into the series that we can find, except for one or two gangster roles in the earliest episodes of The Green Hornet. Todd was very well loved by Trendle, and he told him in a letter after the broadcast where Britt Reed reveals the secret to his father, who then becomes proud of him. He told him, "The way you performed and the way you played Dan Reed on that show, you just made the entire series perfect. He really appreciated it." And Todd, incidentally, had a very bad cold and couldn't make it to the studio that day. They really urged him to come in and play that role. Commissioner Higgins was let in on The Secret. You're all familiar with him. He appeared in two episodes in September and October of 1939, and this big little book called The Green Hornet Strikes. After that, Commissioner Higgins never appears on the show until late 1947, when they decided to write in that he would help aid the police with the end of The Green Hornet, entrusted with The Secret, and keep it all quiet. And, of course, we all know Miss Case later found out The Secret. We also discovered an interesting trivia, and we have to credit Carl Shadow down in Virginia for finding this in the Library of Congress. It was an odd fluke. The program of the station WXYZ ended up getting a boost of wattage, and it became a 5,000-watt transmitting plant. It was dedicated on Thanksgiving Day in November of 39, and it cost about $100,000. They decided 2 years later, don't ask me why they called it the inaugural broadcast. Maybe it took a long time to get the wattage up a little bit. They decided to do a one-time special broadcast, prime time. They canceled regular programming that night, and for 30 minutes, a special drama was done. And it actually crosses over in the same broadcast, Ned Jordan, his secretary, Britt Reed, Lone Ranger, and Tonto in the same broadcast. In the drama, Britt Reed actually meets up with Ned Jordan in a club bar of the Consolidated American Railroad bound for Texas. Each given a mission of vital importance to Washington Channel, the two team up to find Jim Grant, an old man hiding in a cave in a remote part of Texas Hills behind Boot Hill River. Now, you remember where most of the Lone Ranger stories took place? It was in Texas. When the men gave the password Silver, the old man revealed the secret of their mission. When he was a small boy, he held onto a treasure chest containing silver dollars and a note written by the Lone Ranger himself. And the silver dollars were to be used to the best advantage according to the judgment of the man who opened the letter. The Lone Ranger's message was addressed to the Boys and Girls of America, and the Lone Ranger appears in person as the crossover to deliver that special message to kids. Yes, there's something ongoing overseas. It might get worse. Try to save your dollars, but help your fellow Americans while you're at it. The radio cast had everyone who played the roles on the radio series. It was not like someone was filling in for the role. It also marks the first hint that Britt Reed was related to the Lone Ranger, because there was no mention, no trivia, no suggestion, except for this one-time broadcast in February of 41. And we realized that at about that time, we don't know if it was any earlier, but at least in February of 41, Stryker knew there was a connection from the get-go with Dan Reed. And he might have had that. It might have been why a year and a half later, in Christmas of 42, he then introduced Dan Reed to the Lone Ranger series, and not before that. To get kind of towards the closing, and there's the 5,000 wattage advertisement. This is George W. Trendle in 1966. He went to California to help aid with the TV series. He took a look at all the publicity, participated in a bunch of photos with Dan Williams and Bruce Lee from the TV series, and then went back to Michigan, and everything else was correspondence and scripts being passed and forth, where he had to have final approval of the script. There was a number of things he didn't like, including the fireplace that comes down, elevate, if you've seen the TV series. He said, that's hokey, that's silly. He also said, and he was right, in our opinion, Cato should not, absolutely, positively, not be with the Green Hornet fighting. Everyone's going to piece together an Oriental living with one guy and an Oriental fighting with a crime fighter. And Dozier said, it's comic book lore, live with it. He said, people dismiss that. We have to do it. Trendle was probably right. The scripts were improved. But when Trendle stopped helping out with the program, said, I'm done. You guys don't know what you're doing with it. In came Space Aliens from Outer Space. So you get the idea. Trendle knew what he was doing and was keeping the series down to the ground. Many people ask, though, why didn't the series become on TV? The last radio episode was December 40 to 52. So why didn't the show become on TV before that? Turns out it was. Trendle spent money to have a TV pilot in 1952. We don't know anything about it other than the production paperwork and the correspondence. Apparently, this pilot was filmed on the most smallest of budgets. He insisted it could be done in 10,000. And the producers, the people who were going to put it together, said, you don't understand, a situation comedy, reusing the same set for office space and, say, the living room set, at 45,000. That's the cheapest you can make as a situation comedy. He said, okay, how about 15,000? He pushed it, and it got up to about $21,000. He still almost did not pay the fee for that pilot. Supposedly, it was so cheap that Kato and the Green Hornet are wearing Lone Ranger masks. The Black Beauty doesn't speed. It lasts about 21, 22 minutes, not even a full 25 minutes in case it could be used. And for years, Trendle would send a 16-millimeter copy, because he held on to the 35-millimeter positive, and says, send it to different sponsors, watched it. But he only had one, so it was a slow process. One sponsor looked at it, sent it back, one sponsor looked. We've looked in the internal correspondence with those various advertising agencies and companies and dug up correspondence. They were laughing at it. In fact, one of them said, let's humor the old man. Just look at the pilot and send it back. It was so bad. In one letter, he was telling people, well, the Black Beauty will move faster. It will do this and that when we can put the series together. And what we realized is he was apologizing for what they were about to see. And that is probably the reason why the TV series, it took as late as the mid-60s, for William Dozer to convince Trendle to let him do a series. And Trendle also insisted there shouldn't have had been a pilot. The Green Hornet should have sold by name. But he didn't understand on television you need a pilot. They need an idea of what it is. What you see up here is the only picture we have, period. It's an artist rendition of what the gas gun used in the 1952 TV pilot that never aired. This is it. This is all we have, is what the gun looked like. Sadly, also, that pilot does not exist. We've checked with the Trendles, we've checked with all the archives, nobody has a copy. And since he held on to this so jealously, when the one print got scratched so bad, he threw it away and then had another one made, that shows you he didn't have multiple copies. We suspect that you're never going to see that pilot ever. So we are hoping someday someone can surprise us and put something out of an attic, and we'd love to know the backstory to that. August of 1954, George W. Trendle sold to Jack Rather the Lone Ranger, and later on after that Challenge of the Yukon. He always held on to the Green Hornet, saying, it's the property that I really love. I'm going to make something out of that. It turned out to be a big fiasco. When they sold the Lone Ranger in August 54, it was a record-breaking $3 million sale. When they sold Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, it was $2 million. And Raymond Muir told him, look, if you want the Green Hornet, we'll make it $2.5 million. And they said, we don't want the Hornet. By that point, they had seen the pilot, and they said, we don't want the Hornet. So it gave them a bad taste in the mouth. And had Jack Rather bought that, you probably would have seen a series of Green Hornets. And that's incidentally what we suspect is the painting that they were referring to. This is another H.J. Ward painting. This was done in 1939 as well. And we suspect this is the painting they were making reference to when Britt Reed's father reveals to him his passage when he said, see that man riding the white horse? I rode with him on the plane. It's probably the same one. Our research has gone in depth for the last few years, and we'll close this a bit. This is Toyo's handwriting on the back of a script, and we actually had to contact our friend Ben Omar and ask him, talk to your wife who's Japanese, what does this say? And she said it's the same name reprinted over and over. She says, for some reason I can't get the first name, it starts with the letter R, but the last name is Toyo. And we said Raymond Toyo is probably what he's spelling in Japanese. And she later told us Raymond is not a Japanese name. That might have been why it threw her off. It's an American name of sorts. So that's one of the things we dug up. We also dug up what you're seeing there is a registration card submitted for registering your scripts to the Library of Congress, which he did in batches and often with the other programs. In this case, two scripts, one for the Green Hornet and one for Challenge of the Yukon. And you notice the total cost to have a script copyrighted back then, or two scripts to be copyrighted back then, $1 apiece. This came from Todd Grimes in California. A few years ago, he's the guy who does Backyardigans, for kids. If you watch Nick and any of those computer cartoons, you see it, Nickelodeon, Nick at Night, whatever they have on it. I have nieces and nephews. I don't watch all of them. And he created a one-minute TV pilot for the Green Hornet based on a TV series, hence the mask from the nose up over the eyes. He got a bunch of his buddies together. They came up with this idea. They met someone and said, I know the guy in charge of the Green Hornet Incorporated. Why don't we get this pitched to him? Maybe they'll get the TV series. The guy was lying, and it took them years to find that out. When they did, by that point, someone else had optioned to do a Green Hornet cartoon series. It fell through. It never came to be. These are actually still photos of the artwork and some of the direct captures of that one-minute pilot. Also, if you're familiar with the TV series, you'll notice in the back the shelving and the head bust, they tried to reproduce the television series as best they could. And they were going to create an arch nemesis who was always going to get away all the time and battle Green Hornet commonly, and he was going to be an evil scientist. Todd sent these to us and thought people would get a kick out of seeing that. The closing chapter of the Green Hornet we are all familiar with. There's a major motion picture coming out December next year, a little bit more than a year. They are presently filming it right now. This is a poster, sorry, two posters ago when originally it was going to be for June 25, this coming summer. Then they pushed it to July, and they realized, whoops, that competes against Toy Story 3. So they decided to put it to Christmas. It's Christmas of 2010. Seth Rogen is going to play the role of the Green Hornet. Half the people out there have their reservations. We are just hoping for the best. The recent casting that we know of is Edward James Olmos will play the role of Michael Axford. If you're familiar with him from Miami Vice and the recent Battlestar Galactica. And Cameron Diaz is playing the role of Miss Kate. It is based on the 60s TV series, not the radio. And they are changing the lore. His father's name has already been changed. And the Black Beauty gets, apparently, from what we understand, will get mammothly shot up. So we are assuming there's going to be two Black Beauties. And usually with marketing, that's not surprising. I talked to a producer who was originally set up with Universal Studios about why, I asked him why the series never, why the movie never came along. He was real close with Universal. And he said, they told him, well, no, you got to change the script. We need two Black Beauties. Why? It sells twice as many collector cars. And he walked away. So we're not surprised that they're going to do that today. We have a special guest for this afternoon that came in, flew in from California. His name is Jim Harmon. Everyone's familiar with the great radio heroes. He's going to come up on stage for a few minutes and talk about numerous correspondences and getting to know George W. Trendle. After which, we're going to turn the audience over to the audience for some questions to fill in the remaining time.
Hop up on that stage very easily. You mentioned, I have some knowledge because I'm older than anybody here, I think. And I actually had a long correspondence with, I think I'll stand, thank you. I had a long correspondence with George W. Trendle Sr. And I learned a lot of things about him. Mostly, as has been discussed up here, how cheap he was. I had heard this from people who had worked on the show and friends of people who had worked on the show, and I found out about it. But I do want to digress a minute. I also had a correspondence with Lee Allman, to Miss Case, and she was talking about what was Cato's real name? Raymond Hayashi. Well, according to her, her view of him was not as sympathetic as some people's. She said that he also, you know, people who worked on the shows, obviously we've heard, you know, were not very well paid, and a lot of them had other jobs. You know, some of them had car dealerships and that sort of thing. And Hayashi had a restaurant, a very high-scale restaurant that was near near the naval base in Detroit. And according to Lee Allman, he would hang around the table of the naval officers discussing things. And I'm sure that virtually all the people of Japanese descent who were so unfairly put into concentration camps were loyal. But Miss Case's view is that he was not a loyal citizen. He was reporting on what these naval officers were discussing. And according to her, which I now know from the research of these two gentlemen, that it's not entirely accurate, she said that he disappeared the day after Pearl Harbor and was never seen again. But I guess it's a little bit later than that, right? Was Brace Beamer ever, did he ever announce the Green Hornet or have any connection to it? Well, he was one of the Detroit actors there, and I'm always proud to inform people that he was my cousin. He was my my father's cousin, which I used to say he was my second cousin, but the right way to say it, he was my first cousin once removed. And I met him when I was about 6 years old, and I remember he was standing by our piano. He was wearing a double-breasted suit, and he reminded me of our doctor, Dr. Baird. And my mother said, "You know, Jimmy, this is the Lone Ranger." And I saw this man in a double-breasted suit that looked like a prosperous businessman, and I thought, oh, yeah, yeah. But later on, I found out he really was the Lone Ranger on radio. And, that's my sort of connection to the show. And maybe that makes me a second cousin of the Green Hornet. I don't know. But back to great old George W. Trendle. I had tried for years to contact him. I had written him, the only place I could think of writing was care of WXYZ. And, of course, he was not there anymore. And apparently they didn't bother to forward any mail. So I was never able to reach him until my book came out. Until my book came out talking about how cheap George W. Trendle was. And then I heard from him. And he was not happy, of course, and he wanted me to change it for the next edition. And actually, I did change a few things for the paperback edition of The Great Radio Heroes and, you know, put in, you know, pleasantries like later George W. Trendle was more able to amply reward those who worked for him. And I asked him a number of things to identify certain actors, and, you know, like a lot of people from radio, he couldn't remember much. I asked him actually about the Lone Ranger who played Mustang Mag, and he couldn't remember her name, and so forth and so on. George went on to, after I made the changes, he said, "Well, I certainly appreciate that, and I reward all of those who helped me in my endeavors. Can I do anything for you, Jim?" And I thought, well, what can I get out of this guy? And at that time, I was collecting 16-millimeter movie serials. Certainly couldn't afford complete serials. I had random serials, chapters of Captain Marvel and Buck Jones and Riders of Death Valley. And I did buy a complete original print of Tom Nixon in The Miracle Rider. The guy who sold it to me said, "There's only 6 copies left in the world of this. This is an original print." And so I shelled out the money for it. Of course, now you can buy The Miracle Rider for 99 cents at any drugstore on a DVD. but I do have my original crown. So I, at that time, nobody had the Green Hornet cereal. And I said, well, George, I didn't think he would give me a print of it, but I thought maybe he would let me see one. And I said, well, could you loan me a print of the Green Hornet movie cereal? And he said, well, I didn't really care much for that. We don't have a copy of it. Next choice. And, well, I'm going to have to scale down quite a bit. And I remembered that there was a Green Hornet seal ring on the radio program that would let you actually imprint the seal of the Green Hornet. And I said, well, you know, I think around 1947, 48, you were giving away a Green Hornet seal ring. You probably have a, you know, a box full of them left somewhere. I'd like to have one of those. And he said, no, Jim, I have given away all those rings to the boys and girls of America. And I can't help you there. So I kind of gave up on getting my reward from George W. Trumbull, as so many people have. I will say that in my book, The Great Radio Heroes, first one I had out, before Martin Grant took over the market, I had my personal recollection of that that scene where old Dan Reed tells Britt Reed that the masked man on the white horse was a relative of his. And I was really, you know, it really impressed me. I was a teenager, not a child, but, you know, it was, you know, it was sort of a mystical experience almost, you know, a world without end. I was, and I remembered it pretty well. Now, some people have written me and said, well, you didn't get the dialogue exactly right, remembering it after 40 years, but it was close. So I think I kept that legend alive until Mr. Solomonson turned up the original recording. And so that's my little piece of the legend of the Green Hornet. Thank you.
That was Jim Harmon.
Just a brief mention, Mr. Harmon will be here throughout the rest of the weekend, so if you want to talk to him, get his autograph and maybe a copy of one of his books. Fair Manor Media even has a couple copies of his books on his table. Go ahead and do so. He hasn't been over here in probably about a decade, so seriously, you could take advantage and chat with the gentleman. We're going to turn it over for the remaining probably 15, 20 minutes or so for questions from the audience. If Terry's voice can hold out, we're going to let him handle most of those. Oh, and we're going to restate the question for the benefit of the radio audience. So.
I have one comment.
Typewriters and the carbon and the thickness of the paper probably were a little bit thinner by the time you were there.
Hey, I just wondered, that was also the name, of course, of the Japanese buffer for Peter Sellers in Japan. I wonder if that might have been derived from the potato.
Regarding the butler character Cato in the Peter Panther movies, we have not found anything to say that that was a direct connection or relation. We can assume that they were spoofing the character because the name is obviously more pure than John or Jim. but nothing in either producer's archives, and we haven't been able to get hold of Blake Edwards to find that out yet. Yeah, Packard wrote it in 1917, and it was done as a movie serial, and it's very popular for the time. We assume Trendle read it the same year he handed the book to a Striker and said, read this, and try to come up with something along the lines of the Lone Ranger. Questions? The episode's entitled Miss Case Keeps a Secret, and it was done in early the summer of 48. I don't remember the exact date. I'd have to look that up. If you want, I can look it up for you later. He does reveal that to her, that it was more of a matter of necessity. And just a few episodes before that, Stryker, who had a tradition of, if he's going to do something, change in the script, hint it for a few episodes before, she would continuously mention, you know, between you and me, Mr. Reed, I think the Hornet has other ideas. She makes some sly comment at the end of the episode suggesting she's catching on. And that episode, as far as I know, it does exist.
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't guarantee it, but I'm pretty sure it does. Not all of the recordings when I was... when the recordings were turned over to me by Mr. Trendle Jr. Approximately about 9 to 10 years ago. They were stored in a large warehouse in Detroit, and they were in steel banded shut 600-pound wooden crates, so they were a bit awkward to move. Not everything was there, and like the Lone Ranger, a lot of shows were divvied up between the Tannery and Riverside archives. There were two separate buildings, and I don't know whether Mr. Trendle had a fear of losing the first 300 in a fire, so he would do like every other script went to one. Every other script went to another or recording. But the recordings that had survived, that all of which were in that archive in Detroit, were turned over to me along with all of the scripts. This is how we documented this entire book to the detail level we're at. Not all of the recordings were there. As an example, some recordings were intentionally pulled and intentionally destroyed along with the script. We get into that in the book. But I'm pretty sure that recording, but I deal with so many thousands of shows all the time, and this book has been in a lot of detail research and stuff, and I can't recall every single recording that I have a copy of. We have the scripts, but I'm pretty sure that one, we do have a copy of the audio for that one.
Questions from Bill? Well, financially, we'll probably never make our money back.
It's a labor of love, actually.
Yeah, and someone has just broken into writing his first book on old-time radio, consulted Jim Cox and I, and both of us separately apparently had told him the same thing. Don't expect your money back. For Hornet, guesstimating without looking, I'd say Terry and I spent a number of years, but probably about $12,000 in hotel fees, copy fees, travel expenses, just to go to the archives from Wisconsin to Wyoming to Michigan, New York, Florida. It just depends on what we were digging up. And we didn't just blow money for the sheer deviltry of it. If we could get a motel 12 blocks away and it was cheaper, we'll walk 12 blocks. And if we get a library to do it for us, we won't go out to the library.
Yeah, and Marty was actually very instrumental in making me walk those distances. He claimed for my health. I don't know.
Let's talk about Wisconsin and how cold that was.
Yeah.
It's cold in Wisconsin.
You also have to understand when in doing something like this, as Marty and I have traveled a great number of years to not only radio conventions, but we also do film conventions and stuff, and a lot of archive stuff, which is between conventions. And you either really want to do this or you don't, because a lot of times it's very frustrating. He went out to Warner's archive, I think, at one point, and spent 2 weeks out there, and he very meticulously typed all the data into his laptop computer, and he got on a flight and came back, and all of a sudden his hard drive crashed. And I get this phone call because Marty has been very, very good at sending me backup copies on the internet. Great thing for the internet.
Thank goodness we did that.
And I got this panicked phone call one night, and he says, I've just had a hard drive crash, and it doesn't look like I'm going to be able to recover the data. And I don't have Xerox copies. I was literally typing it in. So do you have a copy of the my latest backup? I said, well, what was the latest backup? We date things, and we have certain ways of identifying what it is. And he told me, and I said, yep, it's right here. What's it worth to you? Well, it was either I send it back to him or he's on a plane back out to Warner's for 2 more weeks to recover that data. But also, in addition to archives where you know the archives are at, there are also additional areas that you really need to go to. I'm sure Jim and a few other people that have done serious work on this will validate this statement. It's not the data that you can get to easily. It's the data you really have a hard time getting to. It's not the stories that are told back to you because memories fade. They're inaccurate. And sometimes just downright wrong for a variety of reasons. So over the years, going back to this convention, probably 30 years ago, Fran Stryker Jr. and I have become fast friends over the years. And Fran has always given me pretty much unfettered access to his dad's archives, which he has not done to a lot of other people for a variety of reasons. And so when we have access, including some of the graphics you've seen on these screens today, they came out of Fran Stryker's personal archives and paperwork that you will not find anywhere else. Some of the stuff you probably could find on microfilms if they're television or if they're newspaper advertisements and stuff. But the notes, the personal information that Fran wrote down, who sponsored, when this aired, when this was the first broadcast on Mutual, the first broadcast here, or when certain chains came online, or when certain shows were done on the coast or not broadcast, which was a very rare event. You know, a lot of this information you can't find. You can go to microfilm and it says Green Hornet, Lone Ranger, whatever, that day of the week. But if there was some event, it may not have been broadcast at all, or it may not have been broadcast in that particular region. A lot of that information we also have documented in this book that's never been brought to light before. So it's not easy. It's not the dollar amount. Oh, well, it's the dollar amount, but because we're not, neither one of us, I think, has hit the lottery. We keep trying. But it's really for the love of it. And it's because of my particular interest. The Big Three, as it's called, was my area of interest because I grew up literally almost in the shadow of the antenna of WXYZ, growing up in Detroit. So, and then knowing some of these people personally, like I knew Lee Allman, and I've known a number of other writers and stuff on the series. And then it becomes a little more personal.
Paul said we need to go a few more minutes. One additional thing to mention. To show you how much of a love we have for this, I read one script in 1937. I forget the exact date, but I was reading it and I got dumbstruck because Lenore Case got a letter and she tells Britt Reed, and this is the pre-recorded year. Mr. Reed, you have a letter from your sister Susan. Oh, how's Susan doing? She's still in college. She's going to be coming in town in 2 weeks. You put her up? Sure, let her do that. Now, a typical Stryker would do that, which means 2 weeks later, she's going to come into the series. She never did. The first thing I did before I finished the script was I called Terry. Do you know he had a sister?
And I'll lay you 2-1. There's not a single person in this room that knew he had a sibling.
Question. The number of people who did co-stars is just innumerable. Sometimes they were filling in and so on. For the Green Hornet, there was 4 actors total. Al Hodge was first. He left for military service, and H. Donovan South came in after that. Apparently, I'm following in the footsteps of Hodge. No. he didn't last very long. Robert Hall was number three in the 1947 McCarthy team. But Jack McCarthy took over the role, and he stayed there until the end. Interestingly, Al Hodge, when he came back from the service, attempted and did pretty darn good avoiding Trendle because he realized he could make a lot more money elsewhere, which is why he went to New York when he came back rather than go back to WXYZ and become the Hornet again. Of course, his career then turned towards Captain Video and a number of other sources in New York. But he didn't want to go back to working for Trendle.
I'll tell you one interesting little story. Fred Foy and I have been good friends for a number of years. Fred, at some point, along with a lot of other actors, decided there's got to be something more than just Detroit. So Fred, after a few other people had left Detroit and gone out to the coast, the West Coast, had been encouraged by one or two people to come out. He said, there's a lot of stuff here. So Fred decided to say farewell to WXYZ. They had a big going-away party. He got the traditional watch. You know, it was a lot of hoopla about his departure. And he went out to the coast, moved his family, and after 6 months of browbeating and, beating the pavements, he just wasn't coming up with anything. He was getting a little something here, a little something there, but certainly not enough to sustain a career, let alone a family. So he picked up the phone because some of the directors back at the WXYZ on the departures said, you know, there's always room here for you. You know, we'd love to have you back if you ever want to come back. Well, he picked up the phone. I got to come back. And, of course, it's going to be up to Mr. Trendle. You walked out on him. I can't guarantee you that either, one, you can come back, or that you'll be an announcer again. So Fred shows up, and I guess he was there about the second day, and it was a long hallway in the mansion where they did this broadcast one time. And he was walking down this hallway, Fred was, and through the far door to a private entrance, in comes Mr. Trendle. And they're walking towards each other. And as Fred got closer to Mr. Trendle, he said, good morning, Mr. Trendle. And Mr. Trendle, without missing a beat, pace, speed, certainly not blinking or looking at him, walked past him and says, oh, yeah, Mr. Hollywood. Shortly thereafter, he did get his announcer job back. George Trendle may have been many things to many people, but he wasn't dumb when it came to knowing the right people for the right job to put out the product that everybody wanted.
I have a question over there on the other side of the room.
Going into the detail of one episode, it was once called Huddle on a Cob, and that has to do with the fact that the bus company was in accidents on the streetcar, so that the streetcar likely would be revoked, the franchise, and the bus company could take over. And the villain in that was someone, Mr. Fisher. Of course, history has shown us that there was a conspiracy with General Motors and the union actually doing that throughout the United States on national telegraph. In fact, the WXYZ and George W. Kesmo were in Detroit. Do you know of any repercussions over that particular episode?
Not for that particular episode. I wouldn't be surprised. They did. There was a number of broadcasts that caused lawsuits, concerns. One had apparently a murder on a plane, and one airline said, we think that sounds a lot like the name of our airline, and send letters. But that happened with almost any series. But for that particular episode, I know what you're talking about. They were going to profiteer on the trolleys, and then when the trolleys sabotaged, they were going to profiteer on the bus line. Not for that one particular episode, but that's an interesting point for the time. Another question, George.
I found this one real interesting to talk with you about the actors that have the company. Now, I assume that the reason is not the time period is uncertain. Could you go a little more into
the Warner Lester Manhunter? Ran a total of about 303 broadcasts. From 1931 to 1934, literally January or so of 31 into December, sorry, up to 35, ran about 4 or 5 years. We don't know much about the casting, but we do know Jim Irwin played the role Mike Axford. Somewhere around episode 100, they decided to add numerous villains that were more on the science fiction Fu Manchu approach. And one was considered called Dr. Fang. He was the arch nemesis, and he was definitely like the Fu Manchu character, even had an evil daughter. You can clearly tell there was some influence there. In one episode, he straps down Mike Axter to a chair and literally injects snake venom into his arm and leaves him for dead. And when they find Mike Axter, he's lying on the ground in pain. It turns out he actually took a piece of rope and tied, cut off the entire circulation of his arm, seriously, so the doctors could extract him snake medicine. And Warner Lester turned to his secretary at the end of the episode and said, you know, I'd never have given him the brains to do that, but it saved his life because we were able to take that out and he was able to survive. And that was the arch criminal that got killed. Oddly enough, there was one female villain, Snake Woman of sorts. She lasted about 4 or 5 episodes. And at the very end, which I thought was kind of clever, if you don't see that, and usually there's a death-defying finale, as she was walking away, Axter just pulled a gun and shot her in the back of the head. Turned to Axter and says, done, let's go on. They apparently didn't know how to either kill her off, or Stryker said, why didn't somebody just ever shoot the villain? The series did also spawn another program called Manhunters, and it had a series of different detectives on a rotating basis. Inspector Thorne of Scotland Yard for 5 or 6 episodes. Then Warner Lester would come in and cross over and do a few of those. The Warner Lester series is very popular. And in May of 1934, when Trendle gave a paper to Stryker and said, for $200, as of now, I own the shows you created. And he named the 3 shows. Thrills of the Secret Service, you know nothing about it. Warner Lester Manhunter and The Lone Ranger. Question?
Was the name Reed, R-E-I-D, first used on The Lone Ranger series as the name of the character?
No, I wouldn't be able to write off the top of my head and give you a year.
We're not sure.
Of Reed. Jim Harmon made a point.
Dan Reed in the Christmas of 42 appears on the radio series of The Lone Ranger, and that might be the earliest mention of Reed on the show. I'd like to point out 2 things. The first 791 broadcasts, 774, were not transcribed, so we only have the script. And to this date, we don't know of anyone who's actually sat down and read every single script yet. So when people say the Lone Ranger never had a name, or yes, he had it, John, no one yet turned around and said, here's the episode, here's where it is. So there can still be a first name. It could be in that one episode Stryker wrote, but no one has ever found it yet. And on popularly online, a lot of people say it's John Reed for the Lone Ranger. We tracked that down because heavily on the Internet, it's the Big Fat Reed family tree, and it's copied out of Now Comics.
An older friend of mine, now gone, named Red Bogg. Maybe if any of you here are science fiction fans, you know Red. And he had a great recall of all these early shows. And he said in the beginning of The Lone Ranger, there were references to the fact that the Lone Ranger, unmasked, might be recognized because he was a famous person. There is hints that, you know, had Davy Crockett escaped the Alamo? Was he the Lone Ranger? Was it, was he really Billy the Kid under that mask? And, that was, hinted on in many of the early scripts that apparently, as, Marty is saying, have never been actually read. And I'm sure Red was, his memory was perfect for many things. I'm sure he was correcting this.
We were curious about the Green Hornet comics in the 80s when they mentioned it was John Reed. I asked Ruben, who helped, who was involved with the actual artwork, and I said, in the story, I said, where did you get that? And he said, oh, it was in the 1981 movie. So he didn't even get, even the comics didn't get it from the radio series. So it's possible someone finds someone's going to read a law.
You know, there's a problem that I'm sure Jim has seen over the years. We certainly have seen it. And that is when something goes into print, and if somebody doesn't do their background, it becomes the gospel. And everybody, well, I shouldn't say everybody,
to say there's a number of people that will just plagiarize a lot of data. They will just copy blocks of data and plug it into whatever the new venue is going to be of information. And that is, and that is carried on and on and on, and it just becomes the dust. And it's very hard to beat down. As a very quick example, I know we got to get off here now. The first broadcast of the Lone Ranger. It's a little murky where the first one actually was, but I can guarantee you one thing. It was not the 30th of January, because that's a Monday. The Lone Ranger did not broadcast on Monday, Wednesday, Fridays until November of 33. So, but that date, even by the copyright owners, to this day, and press releases and everything, it's always given out as January 30th. It was not. It was the 31st, and I've proven it about 9 different ways. But that's the date that everybody keeps using.
Okay, we have to actually close this down now. We thank you all for coming. On the way out, there's actually postcards on the end of the table and out in the hallway. If anyone wants to pick up a flyer, a postcard promoting the Green Hornet book, they can. And we are accepting pre-orders to save cost of postage if you want to get a bargain this weekend. Thank you very much for coming.
And hopefully the book will be done justice by everybody's interpretation.
And there you have it. That's the session on the Green Hornet. Panelists were Martin Graham, and the last voice you heard was Terry Solomonson. We are here. I'm Mike Beal.
And I'm Leah Beal.
At the Friends of Old Time Radio 34th Annual Convention.